Well, good morning and welcome to our latest Tenneo Insights call. What a week. 2020 has been a year of seismic events, but the days since our last webinar have been extraordinary by any standards. It feels an age ago that the US TV networks finally called the election for Joe Biden. In fact, it was only last Saturday. Then came news of a coronavirus vaccine said to be 90% effective, sending stock markets and optimism soaring. And late last night, Boris Johnson's most senior advisor, Dominic Cummings, announced he was going, creating a power vacuum at the heart of government. All of this raises enormous questions for business. As ever, our panel is perfectly placed to answer them, as well as discuss the issue we originally set out when we announced this call, the pressures COVID-19 has put on the UK, with many fearing that it's coming apart at the seams. Lord William Hague is a former Foreign Secretary and leader of the Conservative Party. He's now a Tenneo senior advisor. He'll help us with the big picture. Camilla Tominey is the Associate Editor of the Daily Telegraph and an astute commentator on this government and the Conservative Party. She'll tell us what happened and, more importantly, what's next. Vernon Bogdanore is Research Professor at the Institute of Contemporary British History at King's College London. And the eagle-eyed among you will have spotted that Hannah Bardell is not here. She's been unavoidably detained, but her shoes have been more than capably filled by Dr. Philippa Whitford, MP, the Scottish National Party MP for Central Ayrshire. Thanks for stepping in, Philippa. But before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the sidebar of the screen, you can see the chat functions. Put your questions in there, and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of this call. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on this call, apart from Camilla, please hang up now. This isn't intended for broadcast or publication in any further way. William, let's go to you first of all. You always say that you have to get used to volatility in the modern world, but the events of the last week have been volatile by any standards. Can you try in the next few minutes to put it all into perspective for us?
Yes, absolutely. Hello, Craig, and hello to everybody listening to us. And yes, let me try in just a few minutes to cover some of those subjects and what's happened in the last week. Of course, it's big news in the UK this morning that a shake-up of Downing Street advisors is clearly going on. And it's particularly big news because these people have been so influential and important in the government since the general election nearly a year ago. They're brilliant people. I say that because I'm about to criticize them and what they've been doing. But they are brilliant people, formidable campaigners. They outmaneuvered the likes of you, Craig, and me, who are on the Remain side of the Brexit referendum. They showed what they could do in a succession of campaigns, and they've been carrying the torch for that in government. But government is very different from campaigning. A tight group exercising central control can work very well in a campaign. It doesn't work so well in government, which is so complex. And people like me have been arguing throughout this last year from outside government that the government would be stronger in Britain and Boris Johnson would be stronger if he had a brilliant team of ministers directing some hardworking advisors, rather than the other way around, which is what it has often looked like in the last year. So it's potentially good news for Boris Johnson and his government that there is this shakeup, even if it started accidentally or however it has taken place, potentially because it depends on the structure put in place in Downing Street after that. There's often tensions in governments between advisors and ministers. We saw it in the Blair government. We saw it at times in the Thatcher government. And so it depends on the prime minister really finding the right staff and the right solution to this. But it will be welcomed by members of parliament on the whole, most members of parliament in the Conservative Party who have not been happy with the performance of 10 Downing Street in recent months. Now, Boris Johnson is not the same as Donald Trump. I have to point out to people from the United States. We often lump together political figures around the world who benefited from populist voting trends, but not the same. And he's already been talking to President-elect Biden. And all of us in America are calling, in Britain, are calling him President-elect Biden. I think across British politics, we find The current refusal of Trump to recognize reality to be somewhere between ridiculous and sinister, we're not quite sure which end of that spectrum. But the whole of British politics is treating Biden as the president-elect, as is Boris Johnson, who will have been pleased to get the first phone call. It's a sign of the special relationship, which we agonize about here in this country. But what is really going to matter in the special relationship is there is now an opportunity for the UK, the US, other leading democracies to create a common agenda around some of the things that the UK is holds the chair in the coming year, particularly the G7 summit coming up next year and COP26, the most important climate change conference since the Paris Agreement in 2015. And I think that there will now be a lot of work commissioned by the British Foreign Office, who will be hoping to cooperate with the State Department and a Biden White House on a whole series of issues around Biden's stated intention to create a coalition of democracies and to find a more coherent approach to foreign interference in elections, to the regulation of social media, the independence of universities, policy on Hong Kong, a cyber power strategy for the leading democracies in the world, perhaps some initiative that is an answer to China's Belt and Road initiative. So there's quite an exciting, potential exciting space in foreign policy to be filled in the coming months. A final point, because we're all keeping to 5 or 6 minutes. Of course, the cheering news about the vaccine in the last week. I've pointed out on these calls in the past that Oxford scientists have been very, very upbeat about their own vaccine, news of which should come quite soon. At least they're hoping for that. I want to point out one thing here, that this is one of the reasons the 2020s looks set to be a decade of remarkable innovation, much more than the last 20 years, because we are seeing what can be done, a one-year development of an effective vaccine that would have taken 10 years before. I would really, everybody should take note of the words of Jay Powell, the head of the Federal Reserve yesterday, who said the global economy is going to be transformed by the pandemic, in bringing more reliance on technology and automation. And then he pointed out there's going to be a substantial number of workers who are going to need support as they try to find their way in the post-pandemic economy. And that point about inequality and employment opportunities being adversely affected for some people by a new wave of accelerated innovation in the next decade, I think is going to become a central point in politics and economics in the next few years. That's enough from me to begin with, I'm sure.
William, thank you for that. There's a huge amount in there that we want to discuss going forward. Camilla, I'm going to come to you next. Even the most loyal Conservative supporter would say what's gone on in the last few days and few weeks and months has been problematic. Can you give us an insight in what's actually happened in the last few days with these senior advisors going? And more importantly, what do you think is going to happen going forward?
Of course, thank you. And morning, everyone. I think in order to understand what's happened in the last few days, we need to take ourselves back to a year ago and the December general election and just what a miracle really it was that Boris Johnson, a man who had been politically written off in 2016, not least after he had been stabbed in the back or indeed, frankly, the front by Michael Gove during that Tory leadership race, finally ended up being returned as a prime minister with an 80-seat majority. And the people that he entrusted to help him to do that included many of these vote leave players, Dominic Cummings, Lee Kane as his head PR honcho, and then later Downing Street's head of communications, and a number of other key aides who effectively had so successfully campaigned on taking back control and winning the referendum that Boris Johnson knew that the next campaign that they had to win, his election as prime minister with a convincing victory, was entrusted to them. And we all have short memories, don't we? Because coronavirus has been the buzzword of 2020, we forget that Brexit has been the buzzword of the last 3 years and how instrumental the winning of that campaign was for subsequent politics, not just when we think about the eventual evisceration of Theresa May, but also the elevation of Boris Johnson. And I think there are many voters at the time who, faced with the prospect of Jeremy Corbyn in power as a viable alternative, chose to support Boris Johnson, even though they knew that he had some distinct weaknesses. They knew that he was a showman rather than a details man. And regardless of their Remain or Brexit sympathies, and we know that a lot of people supported Johnson, even though they were inherently left-wing in the North and in the so-called Red Wall, because they believed in that slogan of getting Brexit done. So perhaps it's no surprise at all that when he gets into power, he chooses the people that helped him to get Brexit done and achieve that miracle feat of managing to pass a withdrawal agreement deal through the Commons, where Theresa May had failed spectacularly on a number of occasions. That when it came to January, the mission was going to be to get through the transition period with a deal, hopefully, despite all of the rhetoric around no deal, and effectively build on this legacy that he had sold to the public during the campaign and in the Tory party manifesto of building big spending and effectively having this tenure of Johnsonianism. Then the pandemic hit, and I think it swiftly became apparent that his campaigning team wasn't one that was effective at governing, and equally that a buoyant and optimistic prime minister who is very good in good times but perhaps not so good in bad times wasn't quite fit for purpose. You add into this entire mix the fact that he himself gets struck down with COVID so badly that he's in intensive care, and at some point people are thinking it's touch and go as to whether he's actually going to survive. And you then perhaps gain some appreciation for the difficulties that were faced by Downing Street, even back in the spring, let alone when there were subsequent calamities over PPE, the test, track and trace system, and indeed in more recent times, gross indecision about having lockdowns or curfews, second lockdowns. This sense of groupthink having seeped into the sage scientist's advice to the Prime Minister, and him effectively, as he was described to me yesterday by a senior Tory, being the push me, pull you in Dr. Doolittle, you know, being pulled by the scientists on one hand and the doves in his cabinet who want a lockdown in order to protect the NHS, and then the hawks on the other side, led by Rishi Sunak, who are effectively saying we have to save the economy. The other push me, pull you has been this civil war that's broken out within Downing Street between those old vote leavers who helped propel him to power, and indeed the faction led by Carrie Simmons, his fiance, and some of the women in Westminster, including a newcomer, Allegra Stratton, who's a former ITV journalist who is now going to become Downing Street's press secretary, pulling in the other direction and saying the vote leave operation led by Cummings is far too blokey, it's far too dictatorial, it's not welcoming or inclusive enough of the cabinet and indeed of the Tory party. Boris Johnson, you've got a massive party management issue, which seems ridiculous really when you've always been the darling of the Tory party. You've got to get this sorted out. And the flouncing out of Lee Kane, which has been precipitated by some of these women piling enormous pressure on the Prime Minister to reset his team, has then prompted a lot of other vote leavers to say, effectively, when it comes to the end of the year and Brexit has finally been done, we will also leave. Now, of course, that creates a massive power vacuum at a time that one could argue is the most critical for the Prime Minister's premiership. Not only in the sense of having been seen to have fulfilled his promise of getting Brexit done, but also, as William says, with the prospect of a vaccine coming through the ether and the success of that, perhaps depending on how people view Boris Johnson's premiership, but also with the challenges faced by what one presumes is going to be an oncoming recession, the different global political alignment that has been heralded by Joe Biden arriving onto the scene, and of course, a Johnson faced with an uncertain future for post-Brexit Britain. So it couldn't be more important, frankly, as we look into the new year, that this reset and this power vacuum is filled by grown-up people who know what they're doing and can administrate Boris Johnson at probably one of the most difficult times a prime minister has faced in recent memory. And it's a difficult situation because actually Boris Johnson, as we know, and we know from City Hall, and perhaps we should look back to that time and reflect on the fact that his first 12 months as London mayor were, I think, by all accounts, an unmitigated disaster. It was a sense that he had the wrong people around him. He's a great delegator and he's good at actually being the showman while entrusting others to do the job. But if the people that you're entrusting to do the job aren't up to the job, or indeed are doing things in such a sort of psychopathic manner that nothing is working, you've got to really start taking back control, to pardon the pun, of your own team. So I think when we're looking at this from a Westminster lobby perspective, we're very much now going to be looking at the people that the Prime Minister surrounds himself with. I think there's been a sense, and particularly among Tory MPs, who have long hated Dominic Cummings because he's no fan of the Conservative Party or indeed Tories. They actually think that the Prime Minister has been left woefully exposed, that he has been manipulated, that he's been bounced into decisions because nobody's actually got his back. And I think from a lot of my reportage this week, there's this sense that the Conservatives effectively want the Prime Minister to kind of restore power for himself, really. Lots of people have been asking the question, who's really running the country? And that's extremely dangerous for a Prime Minister who's in a fledgling administration. So I think looking forward, we're going to be seeing very much coverage of the people around Johnson and how Johnson tries to pivot now in order to rescue what has been, I think, a pretty disastrous 12 months and try and ensure that he is much more secure in his position looking forward to the next election in 2024.
Camilla, that's fascinating. Thank you very much. Vernon, I'm going to come to you now. You're the leading constitutional expert in the country. A couple of things arise from this is, you know, the power of unelected advisers and their impact on things, but also the pressure that we've seen on the UK throughout coronavirus. I wonder if you could just talk to both of those things.
Well, thank you for calling me a constitutional expert, Craig. It's not too difficult to be a constitutional expert in a country which doesn't have a constitution. And some of my unkind friends at Oxford used to say that a constitutional expert was a historian who'd given his telephone number to the journalists. So I'm not necessarily terribly proud of that description, but Dominic Cummings is going from number 10. He's become a Rasputin hate figure, and many seem to want a Rasputin and hate figure in every government. I mean, we had them under Tony Blair in Alistair Campbell and Peter Mandelson. We had them very long ago with Harold Wilson, Marcia Williams, Lady Falkander, and so on. I just wonder what influence in the long run they really had, or whether they're not just convenient whipping boys and whipping girls for outsiders. I suspect in this government, much greater influence in the long run is wielded by Munira Mirza, the head of the policy unit, who's doing quiet analytical work, which perhaps is not quite so glamorous, not so much in the public eye, but is actually much more important, because whether Cummings is there or not, the fundamental problems remain both in Britain and America. And the fundamental problems that we face are what happens when we get out of COVID. And that, of course, is coinciding with Brexit. Now, so far, Brexit has been Brexit in name only, because we've kept the rules of the internal market and the customs union. From January the 1st, that isn't the case. We're outside both of them. Now, I very much hope that we get a trade deal. We're obviously much better with a trade deal than without. But even if we do, we are still outside the internal market, which I think is more important, because EU tariffs are on the whole fairly low, but it's the regulations that are the key problem. Now, today it's as easy to send goods to Paris or Berlin as it is to Edinburgh from London, but that won't be the case after January the 1st. And there are all sorts of documents that are needed for exporters. Insurance documents, transport documents, invoices and the like. And frankly, they are sometimes used by the EU as a protectionist device. And I just hope that we can cope with that. If you look at another country that's outside the internal market, Turkey, there are huge queues of lorries every day on the Bulgarian border. And that is very, very worrying for Britain. And there's a further worry in the shadow of COVID, because COVID has meant an increase in state intervention. And it's put paid to, if you like, neoliberal ideas, the ideas of a market of Margaret Thatcher and all that. But the only logic of Brexit is, as it were, to have a fourth term of Margaret Thatcher, to reduce taxes, not to raise them. But Rishi Sunak will probably have to raise them. But if you're going to attract entrepreneurs to Britain, you need to lower taxes, you need to reduce tariffs, subsidies, regulations, and so on, if Britain is to become this global power that the Brexiteers want. That's roughly what Australia and New Zealand did when Britain joined the European communities, as the European Union was in the early 1970s. They moved to a more free market economy quite successfully after a period of considerable disruption. And I can't myself see how Brexit can be successful with a more interventionist economy in which taxes have to be raised. And then we also face the problem, and I'm not trying to sound a misery, academics probably do that too often, but we also face the problem that furlough must eventually come to an end. And when that happens, we're in danger of facing an increase in unemployment. So these are the fundamental problems. They're not altered by whether Dominic Cummings is or is not in number 10 Downing Street. And they're probably the most difficult problems any government has had to face since the war.
Okay, Vernon, that's fascinating. Thank you very much. Philippa, coming to you next. You've got a really interesting position. You're a Scottish National Party MP with a ringside seat at Westminster. Over recent weeks, we've seen, you know, Nicola Sturgeon dominating the news. We've also seen the likes of Andy Burnham. And it's raised lots of questions about devolution and how that works. Give us your insights on that and what you're thinking coming from your position as an SNP MP.
Thanks very much, Craig. Obviously, as a last minute substitute and a medic, I have very much focused on the kind of impact of how the COVID responses of the UK and devolved governments are seen across the UK. And you mentioned, obviously, in the north of England, not just the devolved nations. I think what I would say at the start is, you know, there isn't a handbook on COVID-19. All governments have had to find their way through this year. And it wasn't party political at the start. The UK government could easily have asked to create a cross-party task force from the Commons and the Lords, people like myself with a long medical experience, to help with the difficult political decisions that still have to be made on the advice from scientists. But obviously they chose not to. And we've seen criticism mounting over the last year. I mean, in February, it was like banging your head on a brick wall, the complacency and arrogance in the chamber, that looking at Italy and just saying that'll never happen here. And we've seen the ineffectiveness, the problem of lack of PPE, the problems with test and trace, particularly in England, the delay in the world beating app. I just fear the Prime Minister calling the vaccine world beating, and then we are absolutely doomed. The ideological decision not to engage with the EU, either in discussion or in procurement. And we've seen, obviously, what looks from the outside like corruption, and of course what we're touching on this morning, simply increasing chaos in number 10. Now, right at the start, testing needed to increase, and the UK did not have a network of laboratories available. But instead of funding the NHS to expand or even to lead the programme, it was completely outsourced to the commercial laboratories, the lighthouse laboratories. Now, they were not led by the NHS. They do not use or were not using the same safety procedures, quality procedures. And we know from the issue of data being put in a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet, they were certainly not using the kind of data safe databases that the NHS would use. And for us in Scotland and the other devolved nations, the lighthouse labs are under Westminster control, not under the control of the devolved governments, despite health being devolved. And we saw that on a couple of occasions when demands went up in England and appointment slots were removed from Scotland. And then when the Scottish government objected to that, people being advised in England to enter a Scottish postcode to get the permission to go and get a test locally. Now, these people couldn't be removed automatically. It was only when our contact tracers got in touch with them that they discovered they actually lived in Nottingham or Twickenham or whatever. And so that has completely wasted time of the people in our system here for contact tracing, because contact tracing is under devolved government control. And this is somewhere where there's a very strong contrast. In England, community tracing was outsourced to Serco. And even 5 months on, they're barely reaching 80% of infected cases, and they're still reaching less than 60% of their contacts. In Scotland, as the other devolved nations, it's public health based. It's NHS and local public health teams. And we are still reaching consistently over the last 5 months, over 94% of cases and 96% of contacts. We've also seen the UK government handing out contracts for hundreds of millions of pounds without any tendering process, often to tiny companies for PPE who had no experience and with very poor delivery outcomes. And the problem is they're still doing that. And yet it's 8 months on. You know, the processes of tendering and publishing these contracts should now be happening in a more normal, ethical and proper approach. And we've also seen people appear to be appointed because of the connections they have and not their expertise. And that leaves quite a bad taste, I think, in the mouth. One of the critical things in an epidemic is good communication and clear public health messaging. Our First Minister is very clear and direct, and even in response to journalists' questions, she tries to avoid party politics or criticising Westminster. The Prime Minister has a tendency to ramble and go off at tangents. He can be quite flippant. And at the end of some of his speeches, the public health message can still be quite confused. There was a call right at the start to set aside politics, particularly constitutional politics. But if you are a watcher of Westminster, you will see that no opportunity is ever missed to go on about the strength of the union or the broad shoulders of the union, as if the UK was the only country in the world to introduce furlough or business support. COVID has also highlighted to people in the devolved nations the limitations of devolution. We didn't have the financial powers we needed to choose when to go into lockdown, either in March or in September. We don't have control of the external borders. The devolved nations followed the advice of SAGE in late September, and by October were under very tight restrictions and even some areas under full lockdown. The Prime Minister at that time was, of course, mocking lockdown, and he's had to carry out a significant U-turn. But we saw the furlough support to businesses decreasing from 80% down to 60%. Between August and October, leading to increased redundancies, particularly in the vulnerable industries. And despite the devolved nations and the northern mayors repeatedly calling for full furlough to be re-established, the Chancellor kept refusing until the south of England was going to be affected by lockdown, and suddenly furlough was back at 80% within a matter of hours. The contrast in the COVID response is one factor driving support for independence, but it isn't the only one. Much deeper is the UK forcing a hard or no deal Brexit on Scotland against our will. And whether there's a deal or no deal, the bureaucracy and delays at the borders are a given. And this will lead to a massive economic detriment, including for fishermen in my constituency, despite the whole claims that they were the one group who would really benefit from Brexit. And now we have the UK Internal Market Bill, both threatening the Northern Ireland Protocol, but also driving a coach and horses through devolution after 20 years. And this seems to me a very odd approach from people who are unionists to undermine the middle way of devolution, because that forces people to choose either accept a return to Westminster control or take control of your own future. And I would say increasingly, Scots are choosing to do the latter.
Okay, Philip. Thank you for that. Look, we've covered a vast amount of ground there. Let's try and focus this in the questions. Willem and Camilla, I'm going to come to you first. Some of the questions coming through, people are asking, first of all, is this existential for Boris Johnson at all? But also, can you give specifics on what you think he needs to do in order to steady the ship? So, William, I'll start with you and then come to you, Camilla. William, you're on mute.
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Is it existential? Well, the performance of a government over a period is existential for a prime minister. But no, it's not an existential question at the moment. It's not, third MPs are not plotting to overthrow Boris Johnson. They want him to do well. They want him to succeed, but they want the government to be, that the performance of the government to be better than in recent months. And what does he need to do? Well, he does need to have that senior staff at Downing Street who are good at relations with Parliament and across Parliament, and indeed with taking up some of the points we were just hearing from Scotland, good relations with devolved administrations and so on. So, you know, they're quite exceptional people, the people you need to be chief of staff and surrounding staff for a prime minister. So that's a very important choice of person. And then this is an easier thing to say than to do, but he needs a few more Rishi Sunaks. The Conservative Party does at least have the strength in depth of having had a lot of good people come into it in Parliament in the succession of general elections that we've had in the last 5 years. Some of them are already in the middle rank of government. But I hope in future reshuffles, he elevates some of those into strong positions in the cabinet, because a government works well when there is a group of senior colleagues who can argue with each other, you know, not a group of advisors who are determining everything. To take the coalition government as an example, when David Cameron was prime minister, he had every day in his office, in his study, George Osborne, me and Nick Clegg, who argued with him and who said, I'm not sure that's a very good idea, Prime Minister. And that led to the leading politicians in the government coming to a view about, therefore avoiding some of the errors that can easily be made if you get groupthink. And so really that's the sort of change that he needs to be looking for in the government.
Yeah, just picking up, I was going to say, picking up William's theme there, I think he needs to reinstate cabinet government. At the moment, we've got this supine cabinet that doesn't seem to have any power because decisions are being made at subcommittees, largely under Cummings's say-so, and anyone that voices dissent is sort of put in the deep freeze. That's not a way to run government. And actually, I think there are concerns that at the moment, the cabinet, apart from a few exceptions, is a sort of second 11. There are some great Tory grey hairs, if I can call William that. Sorry, William. But, you know, some people of real
calibre. No hair, I'll be grey hair.
Well, let's call the Tory no hairs and grey hairs have been completely frozen out, right? These are MPs with decades of experience who could really contribute a great deal of experience. Well, I'm talking about people like, you know, perhaps Ian Duncan Smith, Owen Paterson.
What about Jeremy Hunt?
Jeremy Hunt, you know, even figures, frankly, like John Redwood. I know they might seem a bit sort of 1980s and 90s, but he's got a really solid understanding of free market capitalism and Tory economics. So the idea that these people are all idiots and should be put in the shade because they're yesterday's men, I think, and women, I think is naive. Talking about women, Boris Johnson needs more women in number 10. And I think we've seen that from this week. You know, a lot of the I mean experienced women who can read the mood on the school playground. And because of this laddish, blokish sort of vote leave culture that has pervaded Downing Street, there's been a lack of understanding of how some of these policies are actually landing. So not just coronavirus, when, God forbid, working mothers were basically told, you'll be staying at home and looking after the kids because we haven't even considered childcare in this first lockdown plan, but also with stuff like the free school meals debacle. I mean, even Tory women on the school playground were uncomfortable with that, just as they were uncomfortable with the fudging of funding formulas. And you wonder whether there is any women who, you know, like might be like me or some of the women watching this who are sort of juggling careers and three children and goodness knows what else, feeding in what people are actually thinking on the streets. I mean, with the greatest respect to Dominic Cummings, I'm sure he's got this enormous brain and he's clearly a very, very clear thinker. But I'm not necessarily sure he's got the sort of finger on the pulse of the kind of people that watch This Morning. And that is really important when you're running the country.
Vernon, I think one of the things that people have been surprised about is the extent to which the devolution has really gone streaking ahead. They're surprised to see Andy Burnham standing outside and leading the news, or the impact that Nicola Sturgeon has had. And the government has been very, very centralised. Has that been a problem for it? Philippa, I'll come to you in a moment, but Vernon first.
There's no doubt that COVID has led to tremendous pressure for greater decentralisation. And as I understand it, the government is intending to produce a white paper shortly on extending devolution to other parts of England, more elected mayors, a stronger system of local government, unitary local government, as was recommended by the Redcliffe-Maud Committee over 50 years ago now, in 1969. I think that's important. What we haven't done with devolution is to get a principled idea of what should remain at the centre if we're going to preserve not just a constitutional and political union, but a social and economic union. And the National Health Service, after all, is a national health service. And therefore, there must be limits to what is devolved. What we devolve are devolved aspects of a national health service. And that was why Anurin Bevan, for example, was so resistant to devolution. I don't agree with that. I was strongly in favour of devolution. But we do need, I think, a charter for what we should devolve and what we shouldn't. So far, we've devolved in an ad hoc and unplanned way in response to political pressures here, there and elsewhere. And we are in great danger, I think, in relation to Scotland, of doing what we did with Northern Ireland during the Stormont period of devolving and forgetting. We do sometimes forget that what happens in Scotland in education and health impacts on the whole United Kingdom. For example, the Scottish government has free university places, which is not the case in the rest of the United Kingdom. But partly to pay for that, they've sacrificed 150,000 places in further education. Now, many would think that was a wrong priority, but whether you think it's right or wrong, if there's a skills shortage in Scotland, it impinges on the whole of the United Kingdom. So we need to be clear over what is a national service and what isn't. And may I just say, I agree with what William Hague says about advisers and the need to offer frank advice. I always remember a story told about Sir Alan Brooke, who was chief of the Imperial General Staff in the war, who was very rough and rude with Churchill in front of other ministers. And one of Churchill's cronies complained to Alan Brooke and said, the Prime Minister thinks you hate him. And Alan Brooke said, I don't hate him, I adore him. But if ever I say he's right when I think he's wrong, he should sack me immediately because I'm no longer of any use to him. And from that point of view, I think it's rather sad that Sir Mark Sedwill is not a cabinet secretary. I think he was a very powerful and effective voice. Now, may I just comment on the other question you raised about what...
I'm actually going to stop you there, Bernard. I can bring you back in a moment, just because I want to bring in Philippa here. The key point I think that Vernon was making there is a really interesting one. Scotland is not front and centre for this government in everyday thought. It is for you. And the reality is that all these situations are a gift for independence. Everybody thinks we're racing towards May next year, whether your party will do very well in Scottish elections. It's been politicised, isn't it? And it's working very well for you.
Well, I think if you took the trouble to look at any of the First Minister's briefings, you would actually see that she goes to great lengths to not politicise it. She does not respond to questions that are party political. She doesn't respond to questions that invite her to attack the Westminster approach. I mean, I would disagree with Vernon that the NHS in Scotland is not a separate entity. It was a separate entity right from 1948. The inspiration for the NHS came from the Highlands and Islands Medical Service, which was set up in 1913. And it is run as a completely separate entity. So it's not just a little bit out. It has a totally different approach and different policies. But I think one of the important things that Camilla raised and Vernon echoed, if the government surrounds themselves, if the Prime Minister surrounds himself with yes men, which is what he has done, then the first challenge to any policy is after it's been made public. So we saw the scrabble back over free school meals in the summer, and they learnt nothing from it. They did it again now, and it looks appalling in the middle of a crisis to say, no, we're not going to feed poor children, you know, and then suddenly we have a U-turn. And we've probably had almost more U-turns in the last year than in previous parliaments. You do need to stress test the decisions that you're making. And the only interest that is taken in Scotland, I would say, after 5 years on the green benches, is very much dismissal, being patronised, and frankly, often quite abusive language within the chamber. Now, obviously, I understand that those who support unionism within the chamber, the government, the Conservatives, totally do not agree with us. But we are the majority party in Scotland, and a lot of people in Scotland watch Parliament live. They actually see the patronising. They see the insulting. I mean, Matt Hancock is relentlessly patronising and dismissive to me, despite me spending 33 years on the front line of the NHS and early in this trying to make what I thought were sensible suggestions, raising the issue of asymptomatic spread, talking about the need to invest in ventilation so that we can get indoor venues made safer, whether hospitality or schools. And always these things are brushed off. And I think the thing they should have done differently in Westminster was to have kept COVID non-party political and to have brought people into it.
So thank you. I'm going to come to some of the questions that are coming through on the chat function here. William, Simon Gorski is asking, how will the perceived impact on the GFA due to the legislation moving through Parliament at the moment on Brexit affect the UK-US relationship in 2021, noting Joe Biden's heritage?
Well, this depends on now what happens to this legislation. From all accounts, in the call that Joe Biden had with Boris Johnson this week, this came up a couple of times, the future of peace in Ireland and the issue of the Northern Ireland Protocol that is separate from peace, but it is, of course, it could have implications. And I think that everybody will have seen the House of Lords heavily defeated the government on this. I was part of that. It's the first time in 31 years, actually, that I'd voted dead against my party. It was quite a thing to see Michael Howard, Ken Clark and me all voting the same way on a European issue, which hasn't happened in a long time, and all against the government of our own party. So you can see there's a lot of hostility to those particular clauses of the Northern Ireland, of the Internal Markets Bill that might break international law. The government will be hoping, I think, that they will do a trade deal with the EU in the next couple of weeks, and that before they have to bring those clauses back again or try to reinsert them, they won't be necessary anymore. And that then they won't have to worry about that issue with Joe Biden. But if there were to be no deal, that there are many reasons, and Vernon was listing some of them earlier, why it would be pretty disastrous if there was no trade deal. Well, if that happened and then they try to insist on those clauses, that will complicate in the US Congress and with a Biden administration achieving a free trade deal with America. So There's just an overwhelming argument for the EU and for the UK to reach a trade deal. They have to, though, both sides have to meet each other halfway with some flexibility on both sides in the next couple of weeks to do that.
Right. Camilla, there's a very good question here from Ton Steiner. He's asking you as a journalist if you agree with the approach of briefing out the COVID updates to the press before public updates, and if you think that's fair. I mean, I think actually what seems to have gone on is that there was a fairly substantial leak, and a lot of people feel that, that was irresponsible. But as a journalist, you also want scoops, don't you?
We do want scoops. I mean, I wasn't happy with that leak because it went to the Times and the Mail and not the Telegraph. And we can't, I won't speculate on why that might have been and who may have been behind it. Yeah, of course we want leaks because that's part and parcel of the day job. But having said that, I think why Boris Johnson was genuinely infuriated by that leak was because he had given an undertaking to Speaker Lindsay Hoyle and indeed the Tory party that they would find out about his plans first. The plan was to introduce that idea of a second lockdown on the Monday, to announce it to Parliament, and then to do a press conference addressing the public. So it's not an over-exaggeration to say he was incandescent. And actually, we can track the last few days' events to that leak originally, really. There's still an inquiry going on. Whether they'll find their so-called chatty rat remains to be seen. But I can understand your frustration. As a journalist, of course, I like leaks. As a member of the public, perhaps I agree with you.
Yeah, as having been a former journalist and worked at the Heart of Number 10, I mean, it seems to me whoever did it was extraordinarily irresponsible because it just meant that the public were just left in confusion and the government was left looking like it was in chaos. And as you say, Camilla, I suspect over the coming days, we'll see how that incident led to quite a significant unravelling of what went on in number 10. Vernon, a question that's coming through here from Keith Raz. He's asking, would a new codified constitution hinder or constrain opportunities for future ad hoc policy divergence between the regions and nations of the UK? So basically, this is the old chestnut about whether or not we should have a written constitution and what impact it'll have.
Well, I hope it wouldn't, but I think the first step to a constitution, which is obviously a long way off, the first step, which I think is very important, is a charter of rights and duties of Westminster and the devolved bodies in relation to powers and functions. What powers it's legitimate to devolve and what must remain at the centre if Britain is to remain a union. Now, I appreciate, of course, that Philippa Whitford wants to go much further. She wants to go for independence, but fair enough. But at the moment, we have devolution. And I think while we have it, we should be much clearer on what can be devolved and what is a UK function. Just as, for example, the EU tries to be clear on what is an EU function and what is a function of a member state's subsidiarity, if you like. And I have no objection to that concept being applied to the devolved bodies. The broader question of a constitution, I think one key factor here is the protection of individual rights, which we did get in the European Union with the European Union's Charter of Fundamental Rights, which Britain and Poland thought they had an opt-out from but didn't. And there was a case in 2017, the Benkhar-Bush case, was important in my view as factor tame in 1991, where the Supreme Court for the first time disapplied part of British legislation because it went against human rights. Now, leaving the EU, we're in a completely unprotected constitution, and we're one of just three countries in that position. The other two are New Zealand, which is a very small country, and Israel, though Israel is trying to develop one. And I do think that is dangerous. Lord Hailsham called it in the 1970s an elective dictatorship, and I think it is very, very worrying that we don't have any protection for rights, which in other countries are given by the constitution and the judiciary. Here, rights are protected by Parliament. And we have to ask ourselves the question whether our MPs are so much more sensitive to the protection of human rights than MPs in other democracies that they should be entrusted with this power. And here I think Philippa Whitford would agree with me because the Scottish Parliament has always taken a very proactive view about human rights, it's fair to say.
Okay. Well, look, one of the big things that's come through in the last week is actually, strangely, climate change and the environment and the fact that COP26 is coming next year. William, you actually mentioned it, and some are seeing it as a straightforward political way to get through to Joe Biden. It's a way that the government can maybe form links with him when he'd been quite suspicious. But it's also being held in Glasgow, Philippa. So presumably that's going to be of huge interest, not just to the Westminster government, but also to the Scottish government, and profoundly important to businesses in your area.
Absolutely. I mean, Scotland has set very challenging climate change targets to achieve, but equally we have huge resource to try to meet that, in that, I mean, Scotland has a quarter of Europe's marine energy potential. We already have, obviously, wind farms. We have the tidal experiments happening up in the Pentland Firth. But we equally have dead weight that comes from Westminster against that, such as the cut to development of tidal power has actually led to two out of the three companies leaving the Pentland Firth. So, you know, a lot of what is our future potential, including hydrogen generation, using old oil rigs, etc. You know, we don't see a recognition in Westminster of the potential that could be there in Scotland. We still have the ridiculous situation that an energy generator on the North Coast or the islands will be charged £30 a unit to transmit into the network. That drops below £10 in England. And if you get to the South Coast, there's actually subsidy for generating power. So where the best renewable energy is around the coast. And yet those areas are really challenged if they want to put in the national grid. And that's our next energy boom after oil. Now, I would agree with Vernon. My husband's German. And of course, Germany has the lender, the 16 lender. And the difference between the decisions that are made federally or in the lender is absolutely clear. And they have a constitutional court where they can challenge if one steps on the other's toes. It's not just the Northern Ireland Protocol. The impact of the UK internal market bill would undermine our minimum unit pricing for alcohol policy. Things like it was often the devolved nations that have banned single-use plastics before England has. There's no derogation for environment or public health. So a whole big area where the devolved nations have actually led and been innovative is suddenly being stifled and shut down by the internal market bill. So far from talking about strengthening devolution, it's being unwound. And the vast majority of people in Scotland, they may not support independence, but they do support devolution.
William, I want to come back to this COP point. Would you be advising the current Prime Minister to really grab hold of it more, COP26? And is it an opportunity as well for business to engage with government?
It's an absolutely crucial time for business to engage with government. But yes, I would advise, and I have advised senior members of the government, that it does really need to be led from the top of government. Of course, there's a there's the problem here of bandwidth at the top of government. There's all the things we've been talking about going on. But Britain, at the same time, over the next year, has this immense responsibility. And so I think it needs to be led from at or near the top of government. It is a very important area to find common cause with the United States, but not just with the United States, indeed with China. We have our differences for good reason with China at the moment, over Hong Kong and so on. But we can't solve global problems without China. And so we do have to try to create a framework of cooperation on these issues. And with China hosting the Conference on Biodiversity in April, and then Britain hosting the Climate Change Conference towards the end of the year, there is the chance to have a common agenda with China. And if that can be done as well as finding pushing this together with the United States, well, then that would really be global Britain in action on the most important issue of all.
Okay, we're coming to the end of the call. I want to put one question that's come from Jenna Tarry to all of you. And if you could just do it in a couple of sentences, because we've limited on time. She's saying, basically, what would you have done differently if you were a government in terms of dealing with COVID-19? And also one sentence on what do you think Boris Johnson should do next, given the position he's in? Camilla.
Not have had such an over-centralised Downing Street approach to the pandemic and indeed the whole of government. And secondly, what would I do next? Surround myself by very capable and experienced grown-ups who I know have got my back.
Vernon.
First part of the question is impossible to answer because this was a new and unknown disease, and everyone's hindsight was better than anyone's foresight. And it's no good relying on the scientists, because one good thing we've got out of this is that the scientists get things just as wrong as people in my profession, which gratifies me enormously. As to what he should do in the future, we face a period of tremendous radical technological change. The government must go with that change, not try and hold it back as we did in the 60s and 70s. That means a huge investment in retraining adult skills and FE. The government's already done a lot in that. I mean, Theresa May's T levels and this government with adult skills, but I suspect not enough. And secondly, very, very generous welfare provisions for those who are disrupted by technological change, who are undergoing retraining in new skills. That is the key if we're going to face this very difficult period ahead.
Philippa, a couple of sentences from you.
Well, obviously, I touched on it in my remarks. I would have kept it cross-party. You know, scientists can tell you the science. Politicians should be able to look at it in the round. And keeping that cross-party, I think, would have helped. There should have been not just a focus on numbers of tests, which became an obsession. It is test, trace, and isolate. And I would have put the NHS leading the testing. And I focus on supporting people to isolate. Less than a quarter of people who should isolate are actually doing it. If you can't put food on the table, you're not going to stay at home. And that is one of the big challenges that remains.
William, conclusion from you.
Well, taking the point about hindsight, so limiting myself to things I did actually say at the time, right at the beginning of the crisis, a test and tracing system needed to be set up faster than it was. And I also wrote about it needed to be a more decentralized system to be effective. So that's what I would have done differently. On the future, well, I can only echo what Vernon just said, and I said a similar thing at the end of my opening remarks. Education and skills, right across all the whole range of abilities and occupations, that is going to be the defining issue of the next few years because of this, the technological change that is now on its way to the whole global economy, and the UK's got to be on top of that.
Thank you. Look, it's been an extraordinarily volatile week in an extraordinarily volatile year. Huge subjects to tackle. You've all been absolutely brilliant at that. I know that everybody's giving you a massive virtual round of applause as we speak. But can I just say thank you so much to William Hague, Philippa Whitford, Camilla Tominey and Vernon Bognor. You're all great. Thank you for your insights. And we'll see you all again soon.
Thank you.